Now, and continuing with tradition, I'd now like to welcome Dr. Philip Lowe, Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia, to address us today. Dr. Lowe will be focusing his area on COVID-19, the labour market and public sector balance sheets. Now, Dr. Lowe commenced as Governor in September 2016. He's Chair of the Reserve Bank Board and Payment Systems Board, Chair of the Council of Financial Regulators. He's also on the FSB Steering Committee. Dr. Lowe is a signatory to the Banking and Finance Oath and Chair of the Financial Markets Foundation for Children and a Director of the Anika Foundation, which brings us, of course, all here today. Dr. Lowe has been a prominent voice in Australia for many years. And that said, I think he's had a profound impact through his steadying influence and voice of reason over the period of the pandemic. His calm and considered communications help to clarify where the focus should be for Australia's economic management in this highly volatile time. Dr. Lowe is heavily quoted in the news media, and that is because we want to hear what he has to say. I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Philip Lowe.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you very much, David, for that very kind introduction. I'd also like to thank everybody on this webinar for your support of the Anika Foundation. As you know, the pandemic that we're all living through is traumatic, very traumatic for our entire community. And as Karen just so tragically reminded us, young people are no exception. Many are anxious about their future job prospects, and many are also suffering from a loss of social connectivity. This means that the work of the Foundation is as important as it's ever been. So thank you for your continuing support. In this year's Anika Foundation talk, I'd like to discuss two topics. The first is the impact of the pandemic on Australia's labour market, and the second is the important role that public sector balance sheets are playing in softening the economic downturn and in building the all-important bridge to the recovery. I wanted to start off with the labour market because for many people, the economic costs of the pandemic really hit home when they or somebody they knew lost their job or their hours were cut. In April and May, employment fell by around 870,000 people, and a further 760,000 people had 0 hours of work, although they still had a job. Many other Australians had their hours cut, with young people bearing a lot of the burden here. As I hope you can see from my first chart, all up, total hours worked in Australia fell by 10%. In just a few weeks. As staggering as this fall is, it's smaller than we had feared. In early May, we're expecting a decline of almost 20% in total hours worked. It's also smaller than the decline we've seen in many other countries. In Canada, for example, hours fell by 28%, and in the United States, they fell by 19%. That compares to our 10%. Fortunately, as you can see from this chart, we now have turned the corner. In June, total hours worked increased by 4% and the number of employed people rose by a record 210,000. Notwithstanding this turnaround, I expect the path ahead to be quite bumpy, and there are still some major cross currents in the labour market at the moment. On the positive side of the ledger, many firms that were heavily affected by the shutdowns are now rehiring, and many are lifting hours as the restrictions are eased in most of the country. As you can see in this next chart, this pickup is most clearly evident in the retail, hospitality and arts and recreation sectors. Some other firms have also hired large numbers of people as they respond to the increase in demand as a result of the pandemic, and the supermarkets are a good example of this. But on the other side of the ledger, there are also factors working in the opposite direction. Through our business liaison, we're hearing that many firms, including in the construction and in professional services, were able to keep many of their employees on over recent months because they had a pipeline of work to complete. But as new orders have declined, this pipeline is fast drying up. If it's not replaced soon, hours worked in these businesses will decline further, just the same time that other parts of the economy are coming back to life. Some firms have also used recent months to reconsider their business models. In some cases, this is because of the decline in demand that's likely to persist for some time. but for other firms, there's been a reassessment of how they manage their workforce. Some firms have identified new opportunities, and there's plenty of innovation going on in Australia at the moment. Yet despite this, the restructuring and the uncertainty about future demand is likely to weigh on our labour market as it recovers over coming months. Adding to this complicated picture is the fact that the unemployment rate is likely to increase further, even with the recovery underway. This is because many of the people who have lost their jobs over recent months have been classified as not in the labour force and so are not counted as unemployed. As the labour market continues to improve, we expect many of these people will start looking for jobs and thus be classified as rejoining the labour force. And this will push up the measured unemployment rate. At the same time, the share of the working age population with a job is also rising. And we saw an example of this just last week when the June figures were released, when despite employment increasing by the record 210,000 people, the unemployment rate also rose to 7.4%, which is a 21-year high. Looking forward, one of the keys to returning to a strong labour market is restoring confidence. This starts with people being confident about their health and about the public health response. The global evidence is that without this, people will be reluctant to resume their normal activities and firms will be reluctant to hire and invest. The other element is people being confident about their own finances and their jobs, and businesses being confident about future demand. Addressing the health issues will obviously help here, but so too will the policy response on the economic front. So this brings me to the second issue that I wanted to talk about, and that's the important role that's being played by public sector balance sheets in softening the economic downturn and in providing the best platform for the Australian economy to recover. I'm going to first talk about the use of the RBA's balance sheet, and then I'm going to talk about the government's balance sheet. As I hope you know, in mid-March, the RBA announced a comprehensive monetary policy package to keep funding costs low and the supply of credit available, especially to small and medium-sized businesses. As part of this package, we've used our balance sheet extensively. We've used it to make sure the financial system has plenty of liquidity. We've used it to address dislocations in the government bond market. We've used it to provide low-cost funding to the banking system so that lenders can support the provision of credit to all their customers. And we've used it to reduce funding costs across the whole economy by having a target of around 25 basis points for the 3-year yield on Australian government bonds. As a result of our measures, as you can see here, the Reserve Bank's balance sheet has increased from around $180 billion prior to the pandemic to around $280 billion today, and I'm expecting further increases over coming months. To date, around $25 billion has been advanced under the funding scheme for the banking system, with 66 ADIs having used the facility so far. We expect further drawings under this facility to be made over coming months, with the total amount currently available standing at $150 billion. This facility is working as expected, and it's contributing to the plentiful supply of liquidity in the Australian financial system. The 3-year yield target's also working well. In the weeks immediately after the announcement of the target, the bank used its balance sheet to purchase around $50 billion of government bonds to support the yield target and to address market dysfunction. But since late April, we scaled these purchases back significantly, and we've not needed to purchase any bonds for some time now. The target is viewed as credible by market participants, not least because it's consistent with the outlook for the cash rate over the next 3 years. There is also a broad understanding in the market that the RBA is prepared to use its balance sheet in whatever quantity is needed to maintain the target. I would now like to address one idea for the use of the Reserve Bank's balance sheet that I sometimes hear. That is, we should use it to create money to finance the government. A variant of this idea is that the central bank should just deposit money in every single bank account in the country. This is sometimes known as helicopter money, because before we had an electronic payment system, the idea was that banknotes could simply be dropped by helicopter and the public would spend them. For some, this idea is seen as a way of avoiding financing constraints. It's seen as holding out the offer of a free lunch of sorts. The central bank unlike any other institution in the country, is able to create money, and the resource costs of creating that money are negligible. So the argument goes, if the government needs money to stimulate the economy, the central bank should simply create it in the public interest. The reality, though, is there is no free lunch. The TAB always has to be paid, and it's paid out of taxes and government revenues in one form or another. And I'd like to explain why, and I'm going to start off with some central bank accounting. When a central bank creates money to finance government spending, it does so by crediting the government's deposit account with it. These extra deposits represent a liability of the central bank. And on the other side of the balance sheet, the central bank might have an IOU from the government to be paid in the future. Now, suppose the additional government spending is successful in stimulating the economy and this starts to push inflation up. At some point, interest rates would need to be increased to avoid inflation rising too far. If this lift in interest rate did not occur, inflation would rise perhaps to very high levels. In this case, it would be through the inflation tax that the community pays for the extra government spending. So there's no free lunch. The spending is just paid for in a different way. Now, instead, suppose that interest rates are increased to avoid high inflation and that's successful. Even then, there's still no free lunch. But how the TAB is paid for depends upon the nature of the arrangements that are in place. One possibility would be for the government to pay back the IOU along with accumulated interest at some point way down the track. Of course, this repayment would need to be funded by future taxes. If instead the IOU was not interest bearing and was not repaid, the central bank would start accumulating losses as the interest rate it paid on its deposit liabilities increased and there was no offsetting income. This would lead to a decline in dividends to the government and possibly the need for a future recapitalisation of the central bank. Both, again, would have to be funded through future tax revenue. Another possibility would be to increase the general level of interest rates to deal with inflation, but to maintain the low interest rate on balances held at the central bank. This approach would limit losses at the central bank, even if the IOU was not interest bearing. But it would effectively amount to a tax on the banking system, as it is the banks that would hold these low interest balances once the government has spent the money stimulating the economy. In this case, it's this tax on the banks that would finance the extra spending. I hope the message here is pretty clear. Someone always pays. It's certainly possible for the central bank to change when and how the spending is paid for. But it is not possible to put aside the government's budget constraint permanently. Where countries have in the past sought to put aside this constraint, the result has been high inflation. Notwithstanding this historical experience, some prominent mainstream economists, including Stan Fisher, a former governor of the Bank of Israel and vice chair of the US Federal Reserve, have recently argued that central bank financing of government spending may be appropriate in some circumstances. In particular, they focused on the situation in which one, conventional monetary policy options have been exhausted, two, the central bank is falling short of its goals, and crucially, three, public debt is high and the government cannot borrow in financial markets on reasonable terms. They argue that under these particular circumstances, central bank financing may be welfare enhancing, provided, and this is a big proviso, there are strong safeguards in place to avoid the inflation problem. The main safeguard proposed is that the amount of monetary financing and the conditions under which it's provided are determined solely by the independent central bank and not by the government. It's envisaged that the central bank provides finance up until the point that its goals for inflation and perhaps unemployment are met. Importantly, the government would continue to determine how the financing is spent. This idea has attracted a lot of attention recently, although many commentators have pointed out, rightly, that there are likely to be very significant challenges in maintaining this type of safeguard over time. It's worth repeating that this proposal is only relevant to the situation where high government debt constrains the ability of a government to provide necessary fiscal stimulus and financing through the normal channels. Clearly, this situation is not relevant to the experience we have in Australia at the moment. So I want to make it very clear that monetary financing of fiscal policy is not an option under consideration in Australia, nor does it need to be. The Australian government is able to finance itself in the bond market, and it can do so on very favourable terms. There's strong demand for government debt, and the Australian government can borrow for 5 years at just 0.4 of 1% and for 10 years at just 0.9 of 1%. As you can see in this chart, these are the lowest borrowing costs since Federation. While monetary financing is not an option in Australia, the Reserve Bank Board continues to review overseas experience with other monetary options, and we had another discussion on this at our meeting 2 weeks ago, and if you've had a chance to look at our minutes released this morning, you would have seen that. It's clear that central banks around the world have all moved in the same general direction, but they have configured their monetary policy support packages differently. Using international experience as a guide, it would have been possible for us to configure the elements of our existing package differently. For example, the various interest rates currently at 25 basis points could have been set lower at, say, 10 basis points. It would have also been possible to introduce a program of government bond purchases beyond that required to achieve the 3-year yield target. And different parameters could have also been chosen for the term funding facility. But after discussing these possibilities at our meeting 2 weeks ago, the board concluded that there was no need to adjust our package of measures, particularly in the current environment. The board has, however, not ruled out future changes to the configuration of this package if developments in Australia and overseas warrant doing so. At our meeting, we also reviewed some alternative monetary policy options. One of these is negative interest rates. There's been no change to the board's view that negative interest rates in Australia are extraordinarily unlikely. Our reading of the international evidence is that the main potential benefit from negative rates is downward pressure on the exchange rate. But negative rates come with costs too. They can cause stresses in the financial system that are unhelpful for the supply of credit, and they can also encourage people to save more rather than spend more. So they can be counterproductive from that perspective too. So this is not a direction we need to head in. Another monetary policy option that's been used overseas is to intervene in the foreign exchange market. The evidence here is that when the exchange rate is broadly in line with its economic fundamentals, as the Australian dollar is right now, this approach has limited effectiveness. It can also involve substantial financial risk to the public balance sheet, and it can complicate our international relationships. So this too is not a direction we need to head in. So the conclusion of our discussions at the July board meeting was that the best course of action is to maintain the mid-March package and to continue to monitor the effects of the pandemic on the economy. The board has not ruled out future change to this package, although it recognises that in the current environment, there are limitations to what more can be achieved through monetary policy. Given these limitations and the outlook for the labour market that I sketched before, there's an important ongoing role for fiscal policy and use of the government's balance sheet. So I'd now like to turn to this issue. Over recent decades, the conventional wisdom has been that the government's balance sheet has a limited role in managing economic fluctuations, with the main focus instead being on structural and intergenerational issues. The global financial crisis and now the pandemic have caused a rethinking here. What we've seen over recent times is the government balance sheet being used to smooth out large shocks to private sector incomes. By smoothing things out, the government is not only helping people right now, but it's also limiting the longer term damage to the economy. The very clear evidence from history is that the deeper and the more protracted a downturn, the more severe are the economic scars. They're scarring through young people not getting onto the jobs ladder or perhaps slipping off it, with permanent effects on their lives. They're scarring through people losing training opportunities with long-term consequences for their career prospects. They're scarring through lower levels of investment in physical capital and in research. And they're scarring through the damage to the fabric of our society and to people's lives that's caused by long spells of unemployment. So we need to do what we can do to limit the severity of these very costly scars. These scars have long-term effects, and they damage our society and they damage our economy. The government can play and is playing an important role here by using its balance sheet to smooth things out and to reduce the severity of the downturn. In doing so, it helps not only in the present, but in the future as well. In principle, this smoothing function can work in a few ways. One is through direct transfers to households and businesses. Another is for the government to spend money directly itself on activities that create jobs. The job seeker and job keeper programs are examples of the former, and spending on infrastructure and on public health are examples of the latter. Both are critically important. By helping the economy today, these measures also support the all-important confidence that I spoke about earlier. So they assist with a return to more normal patterns of spending and consumption without the need for ongoing fiscal support. Now, using the public balance sheet in this way inevitably requires government borrowing against future income. It's through this borrowing that we're able to smooth out the hit to our current income. For a country that's got used to low budget deficits and low levels of public debt, this is coming as quite a change. But it's a change that is entirely manageable and affordable, and it's the right thing to do in the national interest. As I hope you're aware, and as you can see here, government debt in Australia relative to the size of our economy is much lower than it is in most other countries, and it's likely to remain much lower. As I said before, the Australian government can borrow at the lowest rates since Federation. So the public balance sheet is well placed to smooth out the shock to private incomes and support the economy through the pandemic. Looking forward, we should have confidence that the pandemic will pass, either because of scientific breakthroughs or we'll become better at managing its effects. Until it does pass, though, our income will be lower, and it makes sense to smooth this out through fiscal support. At the same time, we do need to recognise that the smoothing task is complicated by the fact that there's still considerable uncertainty about how long this period of weak income will last. The longer it lasts, and the more uncertain things are, the harder it will be to smooth things out. At some point in the future, attention will also rightly return to addressing the ratio of public debt to GDP. It will make sense to do this, as low levels of public debt give us the capacity to use the public balance sheet to smooth out future shocks to private income. And one thing we know, there will be future shocks. When the time does come to address the buildup of debt, the best way to do this will be through economic growth. Given that we are borrowing against our future income, we'll be better placed if that future income is strong. I've spoken on previous occasions about some of the options here and the need for Australia to be a great place for businesses to expand, invest, innovate, and hire people. It's very important that as a country we focus on this, not only to deal with our current challenges, but also our future ones. I'd like to conclude by reminding you all that the foundations of the Australian economy are strong and that at some point the pandemic will pass. We've handled the health crisis better than many other countries, and our economy is also faring better than many others. Public balance sheets in Australia are also in a strong position, and they've been used to deliver unprecedented monetary and fiscal support to the Australian economy. These measures are helping to provide an important bridge to the days when the recovery is well entrenched and we're making renewed progress towards our goal for full employment. Thank you very much for listening and for your support of the Foundation, and I'm happy to answer your questions. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Phil, for delivering another very timely and topical speech. Thank you so much. You would normally be enjoying a thunderous round of applause right now, but we are in a different situation, as you said. So we'll go to questions, and there have been a lot of questions submitted. I'll start with one from a member of the media. This is Edward Boyd from Sky News, who's asked, Governor, what is your reaction to the federal government extending JobKeeper and JobSeeker until March next year?
Well, I welcome the extension and the tailoring of both those measures. They're both providing important support to households and businesses, and they're both playing an important role in reducing the costly scarring to the economy that I spoke about earlier. On Saturday night, I participated in a G20 video meeting of the governors and finance ministers. And one of the main messages from the IMF on that meeting was it's very important that we keep the support measures going. We've got a while till the pandemic is past, and we need to continue to support businesses and households while we're living through the pandemic. The IMF drew to our attention that the biggest policy mistake to make at the moment would to be withdraw the support too early. So I think it's positive that the government's continuing the support. It's positive that the banks have continued their support through loan deferrals. And I can assure you that the RBA will continue to support the economy until we're confident that we're making progress towards 2-3% inflation and towards full employment. So we've got a while to go, and it's important to keep the support going.
Thanks, Phil. There's been quite a few questions about inflation and how it's affected by, as you described, the Reserve Bank's program of buying bonds. So one of the questions came from a student at Pittwater House, but there's been several others of a similar nature. So I'll paraphrase them. Essentially, the question is, why haven't we seen an outbreak of inflation since quantitative easing was greatly expanded overseas during the global financial crisis and now in Australia? And do you anticipate, or when do you anticipate inflation perhaps accelerating back into target?
That's a very good question. Thank you. Inflation is driven by two fundamental factors. The first is expectations of future inflation, and the second is the balance between demand and supply in the economy at a given point in time. On inflation expectations, they're low right around the world at the moment, and they've been low for some time, and it's understandable why that's the case. There's been a significant shock to global supply over recent years, which has been deflationary, and inflation expectations are low, and I think they're going to stay low. The second element is the balance between supply and demand, and at the moment, demand is weak. And despite what the other central banks have done overseas for the past decade by injecting a lot of liquidity into the system, businesses and others don't want to use that liquidity to invest and spend. And so that means that demand is weak relative to supply and inflation's low as a result. So until we can create more aggregate demand in the economy relative to the economy's capacity to supply that, we're going to see inflation stay low. Inflation would pick up if businesses and households around the world said, fantastic, low interest rates, I'm going to go and spend and invest. The problem is they're not using the low interest rates to spend and invest. They're using them to pay back debt and to hunker down. So until we can change that basic dynamic between supply and demand, I think inflation is going to stay low, and that's the world we're going to be in for quite some time.
Thank you. There's a question here from Bill Evans, Chief Economist of the Westpac Banking Group. In a recent speech on policy, Deputy Governor DeBell concluded that the Reserve Bank will maintain the current policies to keep borrowing costs low and credit available, and stands ready to do more as circumstances warrant. Could you provide us with some insights into what is meant by do more? Deputy Governor DeBell referring simply to more bond purchases, or was it an extension to the current set of policy tools?
The extension to the current set of policy tools, I went through some of those. The main ones were intervention in the foreign exchange market and having negative interest rates. We effectively rule those out unless something were really fundamentally changing in the global economy. So I think they're both very, very unlikely. There is the possibility, and we've reviewed this, to change the configuration of the current package, and I talked about that in my prepared remarks. It is possible that we could lower the interest rate set at 25 basis points down to 10. And it's possible we could buy government bonds. And it's also possible that we could change the parameters of the term funding facility. At the moment, our judgment is that moving in any of those directions is likely to have very little benefit. Now, the problems the country faces don't arise because interest rates are 25 rather than 10 basis points. There are much more fundamental things at play. If we came to the view that moving in any of those directions was going to be helpful for the recovery, then we're prepared to do it. At the moment, we don't see the case to do that. I think the best course of action is to hold steady with the March package, see how that plays out, see how we recover, see how the fiscal support goes, and then make a further judgment in the light of both our own experience and that overseas. So we're not out of options. But exercising any of those options right at the moment isn't the right thing to do, but it could become the right thing to do a bit down the track.
Thanks, Phil. There's been numerous questions on the Australian dollar, and I'll ask one from Will Kalouris, who asked, at what level will the Reserve Bank become more concerned about Aussie dollar? It's been remarkably stable over the last month. At what sort of levels on either against the US or in trade wider terms, do you get a little nervous about the persistent strength of the Aussie dollar?
Yeah, we don't think in terms of specific numbers for levels. It really comes down to how is the exchange rate moving in line with the economic fundamentals. So the kind of the number that would generate concern moves with the economic fundamentals. Over recent times, the Australian dollars, it fell, but then it rose back up, and it's basically where it is at the beginning of the year, where it was at the beginning of the year. The US dollar is now weakening a bit, and the Australian dollar's moving up. Commodity prices have recovered some of the falls, and the interest differentials are pretty narrow at the moment. So you can't, at the moment, make the case the Australian dollar is misaligned. If it to move a long way from the current value and the fundamentals didn't change, so you could make an argument it became misaligned and we'd have to think about what to do. But at the moment, I don't think you can make that case. As I've been saying for a long time, I would like to see a lower Australian dollar because a lower dollar would mean more jobs, Australian business being more competitive, and it would also push up prices and get us closer to the inflation target. But the Australian dollar is set in the value is set in the market, and we're not going to intervene to force it lower in the current circumstances.
Governor, there's been a few questions about the most recent shutdown in Victoria. What's the bank's assessment of the likely impact? Is it too early to tell? Some troubling numbers today. What's the bank's assessment of perhaps the impact of the shutdown and border closures between Victoria and New South Wales in particular?
Well, it's perhaps staying the obvious to say what's happening is very concerning and we're watching it very carefully. It's very concerning not just because of the people involved but also the effects on the economy, and it's served as a reminder to us all just how infectious this virus is and how we all need to take so much care. It's also a reminder that if we don't address people's health concerns, it's very hard to get back to a normal functioning economy. With the situation still so fluid, we've not yet worked through the effect on the forecasts. We're currently now starting a forecasting round and we'll provide a full set of economic forecasts in early August with a statement of monetary policy. But right at the moment, it's too fluid and I wouldn't like to conjecture a number, but it is very concerning.
Thanks, Governor. Sarah Hunter, Chief Economist of BIS Oxford Economics, has asked, how important does the Reserve Bank see overseas migration to the economic recovery? given it has been a key driver of growth in recent years?
How important is the recovery? I think it's a critical factor for the recovery. The critical factor is restoring people's confidence so that people prepared to go and spend and firms hire and invest. At the margin, I think faster population growth will help that, but the fundamental thing is to address the health concerns. And if we can do that, then I think we can recover quite strongly. The government's injected a lot of stimulus, so has the Reserve Bank. The banks have supported people. So if we can overcome the health situation, then I think we can recover quite strongly. But if we can't give people confidence about the health, the recovery is going to be very bumpy and very drawn out. I think longer term, if we move back to a world of lower immigration, then inevitably we'll have lower economic growth, because it's been a very important factor driving growth in nominal and real GDP over recent years. So coming out of the pandemic, that's one of the issues we're going to have to address, but there are a lot of other issues that we'll have to address coming out of the pandemic. So I think people are going to be more cautious. That's going to affect household spending and business appetite to invest. For quite a while, we're going to have high unemployment and we're going to have quite weak wages growth. It's quite possible that we see wage numbers starting with a 1 rather than a 2, which I think is regrettable. Less appetite to borrow and a changed property market. So there are going to be a lot of shadows of this pandemic that lasts quite a few years, and lower population growth might be one of them. But the recovery really requires people to be confident about their health and their jobs and businesses about future demand. That's the critical thing now, generating that confidence.
There's another question on inflation and related to your comments about central bank financing of government spending. So it's from Michael Yander. Given how persistently low inflation is, isn't now the best possible time to experiment with modest central bank financing of government spending in an effort to edge inflation back towards the target range? Hyperinflation does not seem to be an immediate threat.
I would agree with part of that and disagree with another part. Hyperinflation is not an immediate threat. I would agree very strongly with that. I don't think we need to experiment with monetary financing. I think it would be a big mistake. As I said, the Australian government can borrow at the lowest interest rate since Federation. There's very strong demand for Australian government debt. There's a relatively little government debt on issue out there. Australia enjoys a high credit rating, enjoys a reputation for being a well-managed country with solid, sound, predictable policy frameworks. So the government has no trouble accessing finance to undertake the fiscal expenditure that it wanted. It doesn't need help from the central bank. And I think if we were to provide government financing, the confidence that's been built up around our institutional arrangements would weaken, and that would be bad for confidence, investment and jobs over time. So, no, we don't need to go down that route.
There's another question here from Anonymous. To what extent are you a little nervous from the expedited ABS weekly payrolls data that showed a weakening in both employment and hours towards the end of June that may suggest that perhaps the slowdown is evolving from a shock to particular sectors to a broader demand shock across the economy?
Well, we've noted kind of that slowdown in employment growth, and after the initial bounce, things do look like they're plateauing out at the moment. That's a concern. And it partly reflects these various dynamics in the labour market that I was talking about. While some firms are bouncing back in hospitality, they're hiring people again, and people are going back to restaurants in most of the country, and that's good for jobs. There are these other firms that are moving in the opposite direction. They've been able to survive because they had a big pipeline of work. That pipeline's run off and they're not getting many new contracts. Firms don't want to invest, so they're not selling many new contracts. And we're seeing some industries flatline or in some cases actually go backwards slightly. And we're seeing a whole number of other firms decide to restructure because they don't think demand's going to come back anytime soon. So it's a very complicated picture. We will recover, but the recovery is going to be bumpy and I think it's going to be drawn out. The only thing that would change that is a major breakthrough by the world scientists, giving people confidence about their health. I think if that were to happen, then we could see a very strong, robust bounce back. But while ever this uncertainty about the health situation lingers, it's going to be a bumpy, drawn-out recovery, and there's going to be a shadow over our economy for some time. This is why I keep coming back to the structural reforms that will help move us out of that shadow.
There's a question here about your purchases of government bonds from Phil O'Donohoe from Deutsche Bank. You made clear again today that you are satisfied that the three-year yields are around the target of 0.25%. How far away from 0.25 would three-year yields need to move before it would warrant a restart of bond buying? In other words, at what point does around 0.25 no longer apply?
I don't want to put a number on that for obvious reasons. We've seen a couple of episodes, including late last week, since the target's been in place, where yields have kind of moved from 25, 27, 28 basis points, and then they settle down again. A couple of occasions where that's occurred, there's been some indigestion in the market, and the yields quickly settle down again. So for us to come back into the market, we'd need to see these rates be sustainably higher and not just driven in the short term by market indigestion as some new bond lines come on. We will do whatever's required to make sure the yield settles around 25 basis points, but it's never been our intention to make sure it's 25.00 every day. Some tolerance for variation around it. I think the market understands that, and I hope the credibility of that target means that we can continue to achieve it without further purchases of bonds. But if we need to, we will. But we're not going to set kind of a specific number. If it goes above 30 or 32, then we'll jump into the market. It's really a judgment about what market conditions are.
Governor, there's one from Sam Harrison. How concerned are you that job seeker recipients were receiving more money than they previously were and some of the disincentives that may have been providing to those seeking employment? I notice obviously the government's announcements this morning is addressing that, but has that been a major factor in your assessment of what's happening in the labour market, or labour supply particularly?
No, it has not been a major factor, and note the Prime Minister addressed this in his press conference early today, so I don't have anything to add to it. I mean, there are no doubt some cases where people getting job seeker and that reduce their incentive to seek out a job. So I'm sure there are some cases of that in the country, but I think it's important that we don't kind of draw a general lesson from just a handful of cases. The vast bulk of people who are on job seeker could not find a job because there were no jobs, because the country was shutting down, or certain industries in the country were shutting down. So the vast bulk of these people were not working because there were no jobs for them. So I think it's a mistake to kind of focus on just the relatively small number of cases where people were not working because they didn't have an incentive to. Over time, obviously, we need to address this and make sure the incentives are aligned. But for the past 3 months, there were no jobs for many people. That's the reality we faced.
Mm. Phil, there's been a lot of questions about structural reform, and you mentioned it in your remarks. And again, I'm paraphrasing several questions. What do you think, how big an opportunity is this for the nation to undertake some of those more difficult reforms, including in the tax system?
Well, how big an opportunity, I don't know. This is in the world of politics, so it's not my area of expertise, or it's not appropriate I speak to it, other than to recite for you the long list of recommendations that have come out of the many thorough and worthy reports that have addressed these issues. the tax system, the balance we have between income taxes, consumption taxes and land taxes. I don't think many people would say that was optimal. The way we price and invest in infrastructure, in many cases we have excess regulation that's too complicated. There are issues in the industrial relations system, the way we do skills and human capital developments, probably room for improvement. And the incentives we set up through both our culture and through the tax system for entrepreneurship and innovation. I mean, these are the areas we need to look at. Whether it's an opportunity or not, I hope that we can look at some of these areas. As I said in my prepared remarks, what we're doing today and what we should be doing is borrowing against our future income to support people today. It's really important we do that, and the government is doing that, and I'm very pleased to see that. But we need to make sure our future income is strong, because at some point we'll want to get the debt ratio back down again. The best way to do that is having strong future income. And the issues I just quickly ran through, they're the issues we should be addressing to give us the best chance of having strong future income. If we decide not to tackle any of those because they're too difficult, then our future income will not be as strong as we'd hoped, and we'll have borrowed against a less strong future income, and that will constrain our choices in lots of different areas. So it's really important we address these issues. Whether it's the opportunity to do it, I'll leave others to comment on that.
No, thank you. And we'll make this the final question, Phil. There's been, again, this will be a paraphrase of several questions about the housing market. One element has been about, are you concerned about how younger generations may be disproportionately affected by COVID-19 and therefore their ability to get into the housing market? And others is just your general assessment of how the pandemic is affecting conditions in housing in the major cities.
My main concern for younger people isn't that they won't be able to get into the housing market, they won't have a job. They won't have a training opportunity. They come out of university and they can't get a job, or they finish school and can't get a job and they can't get the training that's really important in those kind of years between 18 and 25. So that's my main concern. If they get jobs and they get training, then I think the housing situation will inevitably look after itself one way or another. So that's, you know, making sure that young people have jobs is that should be our priority at the moment. What's going on in the housing market? I've been very pleased to see the amount of refinancing going on. For many years, I've been in lots of public forums, I've been encouraging people to look at the rate they were getting from their bank, and if they weren't getting a very low rate, go and knock on the door and set up a Zoom conference with their banker and ask for a better deal. And if the bank said no, go to another bank. And one positive out of the pandemic, I think, is people have been sitting at home and looking for better deals on their mortgages. So we've seen huge amounts of refinancing in the last couple of months. The value of refinance loans was almost as high as the number of loans for newly purchased properties. That's the first time in our history. So there's been a lot of refinancing. People get a better deal. It frees up some cash flow and it puts some extra competitive discipline into the banking system. So I encourage people who haven't already taken up the opportunity to do that to look at their mortgage rate and look for a better deal. So that's helping cash flow. And the housing market, as I said, has held up as well as I would hope. And much depends from here upon what happens with the unemployment rate and whether people have jobs. So most questions come back to jobs. We've got to do our best to make sure that people have jobs, and what the Reserve Bank is doing will help that to the maximum extent we can. And I'm encouraged by the government's announcement today that will help with job retention and ultimately job creation over coming months.